used against him to prove his guilt. At the outset, I think it's really important to consider what actually happened in this case. In this case, there is no dispute that the prosecution knew of Exhibits 22 and 23 only because they were provided them in Mr. Spinner's 19.2-264.3:1 disclosure. The Commonwealth's attorney admitted in this case that he read Mr. Spinner's disclosure and that he later thought to himself, those records would be valuable in my case in chief. So he called over and called a witness specifically for the purposes of bringing these exhibits to court and admitting them into evidence. It is further not in dispute that Mr. Spinner made his disclosure nearly 2.5 years after he was arrested for this crime, giving the Commonwealth ample time to investigate. He also made it exactly 60 days before his then-scheduled trial date, which was the last possible date on which he could make this disclosure under subsection B of 3:1, without waiving his right to present mental health testimony.
But counsel, arguably the records in terms of the disclosure are of the nature of mental health records. The records that were actually disclosed were not. They were like jail booking records and things of that nature. Are those records that fit within the disclosure part of the statute?
Yes, Your Honor. The first thing that we should look at is the language of the statute. Under 3:1, a defendant giving notice of his intent to present mental health expert testimony at the capital sentencing must provide the prosecution not only with the expert's report, but also psychiatric, psychological, medical, or other records obtained during the course of the evaluation. So, or other records is a very broad phrase, and because psychiatric, psychological, and medical records are actually named explicitly in the phrase, it is clear that or other records encompasses records other than those that would be, say, for example, covered by HIPAA or another privacy right. And notably, they are all also third-party records. None of them are records that are created by Mr. Spinner, belying the argument that 3:1 does not apply to third-party records. 3:3 applies by its own terms not only to the defendant's statements, but also the defendant's disclosures. 3:3 refers three separate times to statements or disclosures, meaning that the words are not interchangeable. The disclosures that are protected under 3:3 must be something other than the defendant's statements. And when read in conjunction with 3:1, it is obvious that the only disclosures discussed in 3:1 are these mandatory records disclosures that are made by the defendant.
Counsel, may I ask, if we embrace your argument, then obviously you contend it was error, but why wouldn't it be harmless error? I mean, what we found out, unless you know differently, what we found out was what he had when he came into custody, when he came through the Sally Port, whatever monies that he had and contents of his wallet, that's what was obtained. That was, as Judge Malvo pointed out, would have been available by subpoena, although you apparently had a very forthcoming Commonwealth attorney who admitted that he got them from your disclosure. And why would it really not be harmless error?
Yes, Your Honor, I have a couple answers for that. The first one is that I've begun with the statutory aspect of my argument, but this is also a constitutional error under both the Fifth and the Sixth Amendment. Frankly, I think the Sixth Amendment violation is the most clear, because in this case, you are forcing capital counsel to choose between conducting a thorough, competent mental health and mitigation investigation and preparation, and provide that information to the Commonwealth, or simply not conduct and prepare their mental health testimony. So either way, counsel is going to be ineffective, and that's a Sixth Amendment problem. The reason that's important is because that puts us under the harmless error standard of California v. Chapman. The error has to be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. But even if the court finds this case on statutory grounds, the court still has to have confidence that the evidence only had a slight effect, and that is not the case here. In this case, motive was extremely important. This was a purely circumstantial case. There was no physical evidence against Mr. Spinner, and there was no evidence of any bad blood between Mr. Spinner and the victim in this case.
Well, except for in terms of the facts, there was the insurance card that was found in the car. There were the mother and daughter that saw a vehicle with a person matching his description leaving from the area where the murder had occurred. So there was direct evidence, maybe not physical in the sense of blood or things or a weapon, but there was direct evidence. So how would that bear upon your argument?
Well, Your Honor, there were certainly other circumstances that the court found compelling. However, the court in its verdict said, this case is like a puzzle, and I find that the puzzle pieces fit together and they are complete. And motive was an important one of those pieces. It was one that the Commonwealth spent a great deal of time on. The Commonwealth, in both opening and closing, talked about the fact that we know that Mr. Spinner was poor and that he needed money, and that for a man that had no money.
Counsel, may I interrupt you again, and I do apologize, but yes, I think it was established that he was poor, because that was established through cumulative evidence, and there was testimony in reference to his bank records and in reference to other parties who testified that said he didn't have any money. I mean, they knew that. So learning that, and I don't recall whether it was it $30 or $40? I don't recall the exact amount he had in his wallet when he was taken into custody. But nevertheless, it was already, that point had already been established by other cumulative evidence. Do you dispute that?
Yes, respectfully, Your Honor, I disagree. The Commonwealth attorney clearly did not feel that this evidence was cumulative. It was very important to the Commonwealth. And I think the reason for that is because there are other evidence of the amount of money that Mr. Spinner had around the time of the crime is twofold. One, there was the evidence of the bank accounts, but those were joint bank accounts with Tamara Spinner, and there was also evidence that he and his then wife were estranged and not living together. He was staying at his brother's house, which is where he was searched. So it stands to reason that the parties may have withdrawn money from those accounts. The other evidence was that there was approximately $5 found in Mr. Spinner's wallet during the search of the house. However, that left open the possibility that Mr. Spinner could have money elsewhere, like many people do. What's damaging about this evidence is that when people go to jail, they need money in jail. You bring your money to jail so that you can buy commissary and put money on your phones and fulfill your other basic human needs. And the evidence in this case was he only had $8.52 to his name when he went to jail. And I think if we look at the Commonwealth's opening statement, it becomes clear how important to them this was. The Commonwealth says this was not an afterthought. This was a felony murder, which is also important. This is a felony murder robbery case. And we're going to prove that Mr. Spinner had no money two ways. One, by evidence that he had only $8.52 when he was booked into the jail, and two, by evidence from a statement of indigency that showed that he had no cash or assets on hand when he asked for an attorney. So the Commonwealth attempted to admit the latter piece of evidence into the trial, and the trial court sustained the defense objection to that evidence, leaving them only with this $8.52. The Commonwealth argued $8.52 in opening, they argued it in closing, and they called Pappy Mueller to trial for this sole purpose. So I think that the passion with which the Commonwealth worked to get this evidence in and the emphasis that they placed on it belies the harmless error, especially because it's a constitutional error in this case and it has to be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Notably, Your Honor, if the court adopts the Commonwealth's interpretation of these statutes, it will render the statutory scheme unconstitutional. And I think that's really important because this scheme has been in place for approximately 30 years. And capital defendants and capital prosecutors have been relying on it for all that time. And the entire reason that the statutory scheme is constitutional is because capital defendants can undergo an evaluation and have faith in the fact that their records will be kept confidential and for use only for a limited rebuttal exception. And that limited rebuttal exception comes directly from United States Supreme Court case law. Beginning with Estelle v. Smith in 1981, the United States Supreme Court said, you can't compel a defendant to undergo a mental health evaluation and then use the results of that evaluation against him. The court then said later in Canada versus Kentucky and Kansas versus Cheever that there is one exception to that, which is a limited rebuttal exception. If the defendant puts on a mental state defense, then the prosecution can use the derivatives of his evaluation or their own evaluation as evidence in rebuttal. And what 3:3 does is simply codify that limited rebuttal exception. Now, Virginia is a little unusual in that in Virginia, you're also required to hand over your records and not just make statements. So that's a little bit of an unusual circumstance. But for that reason, 3:3 covers both statements or disclosures. So what we're doing here with these statutes, what the legislature certainly codified a limited rebuttal exception that is meant to protect both the defendant's interests in investigating, preparing, and presenting a mental health case and mitigation, and also protect the Commonwealth's interest in being able to rebut that. But the problem is it's not a discovery statute. It doesn't open the door for the Commonwealth to take evidence from a defendant's disclosures and then present it against him in his case.
Are there cases out there that talk about during the booking process that there is not the same Fifth Amendment implication that you would typically see in other types of encounters with law enforcement?
Yes, Your Honor, and we completely agree that if the prosecution had simply obtained these records from the jail directly without being informed of them only by Mr. Spinner's disclosure, that there would have been no Fifth Amendment protection. The reason there's constitutional protection here, both Fifth and I think even more clearly Sixth Amendment protection, is because this was not the product of the prosecution's own investigation.
So your argument is not not that they had it, it's how they got it.
Yes, Your Honor, absolutely. 3:1 and 3:3 refer to making use of the defendant's disclosures. And what matters is whether the prosecution is making use of the disclosures or of its own independent investigation. And the Commonwealth raises some questions about how this might affect the process. But I would say, again, in Virginia, this has worked for many years, and this has never been a problem before. And I think the federal court experience is very instructive. Because prior to 2002, in federal court, the trial courts were left to fashion their own rules about how to go about this. And many of the courts implemented sealing orders or had the prosecution appoint taint attorneys or different mechanisms to make sure that the contents of the evaluation were protected.
If we were to agree with you and your arguments that you're making in this regard, what remedy do you believe would be appropriate?
It would be appropriate to reverse and remand Mr. Spinner's convictions for a new trial.
Without the use of this evidence that you contend is inappropriately in the possession and use of the Commonwealth?
Yes, Your Honor. If I may, in 2002, when the federal court amended the rules, when the Federal Advisory Committee amended the rules, they specifically provided that the prosecution does not now receive the contents of the evaluation unless and until the defendant is convicted of a death-eligible offense. And that's really important because, as the Advisory Committee noted, the Fifth Amendment privilege isn't actually waived until there is a mental state defense under Estelle, Buchanan, and Cheever for the prosecution to respond to. Now, that, I think, the
trial aspects are different from the sentencing aspects. This is what you're suggesting.
Yes, Your Honor. And also that may be a better way to have the system, and I think that's part of what the Commonwealth is suggesting. Well, we have to work with the system that the legislature gave us. And what we have here is a carefully designed system that has worked for many years in which a defendant makes his disclosures and the prosecution simply doesn't look at them if they're not ready to. They don't get to use them against the defendant, and they know that. And so I think there are many remedies for a concerned prosecutor who feels like, maybe I'm not done with my investigation. That prosecutor can either ask the court to seal the records or can appoint a taint attorney in their own office, can firewall someone, or frankly, can simply not open the envelope. And that's simply not what happened in this case. What we have here is a Commonwealth attorney who admittedly used these records that he received directly from Mr. Spinner's 3:1 disclosures because he thought they would be valuable.
I was with you until you said, don't open the envelope. Wouldn't that frustrate the entire purpose of receiving the information? If the government doesn't know what's going on, how are they able to respond? I didn't follow you there.
Yes, Your Honor. So in federal court, the way this is typically done is it's actually provided directly to the mental health expert for the prosecution who conducts his own evaluation and reviews the contents of the defendant's evaluation and sort of independently works that up. And then when there is a conviction of a death-eligible offense, the attorneys also become privy to the knowledge.
Okay. I see what you're saying.
And then, of course, if the prosecution feels that they need more time to conduct an investigation, the parties can also always ask for a continuance. In this case, we're 2.5 years into trial preparation when Mr. Spinner made his disclosures. And frankly, there's simply no allegation from the Commonwealth that they ever were going to get these records. This is not a case where the Commonwealth says, well, we would have gotten these and we simply hadn't had a chance to do so yet. They admittedly got these only because of Mr. Spinner's criminal disclosures. that will respond some more.
Thank you, counsel. You used up all your rebuttal time, but I'll give you a minute once we hear from opposing counsel. Thank you.
Thank you.
It's good to reserve something you don't have. I tried that off. Dilemma that we're sort of confronted with here is that fact that, and I give the prosecutor credit, acknowledged that but for getting this information from this source, they might not have been aware of it, and obviously it was a benefit to the prosecution to have this information, particularly in light of the theory of the case that the government was propounding during the prosecution. Doesn't that make this the type of constitutional error that we need to take a serious look at?
I don't think it does, Judge, and the facts of this case, particularly in the nature of the documents. The trial court's finding, as we've parsed on brief, was not that you can use all these records once you no longer have death penalty and capital trial. The trial court's finding was that this jail record is not a disclosure by the defendant within the scope of the protection of the statute.
Counsel, what about the argument that the appellant made about the other documents? Would that qualify? And
I
if
don't
so,
think it
then.
The Mr. Penner on brief acknowledges that the purpose of, and again this morning, that the purpose of this 3:3 is to put into effect the limitations under Estelle and later Buchanan and Light cases. Those cases are concerned with the Fifth Amendment privilege protection, so the defendant can freely speak to mental health experts, so he can get medical records, so he can get other psychological records. All the records that are litigated under Estelle and Buchanan, and we argue that are at issue with this statute, are records of that nature. That is, records that would be subject, and are subject, to Fifth Amendment protection, the privilege against self-determination. The other records, I think, can't be lifted out of this context of the statute and understood. It enumerates several specific sorts of records that are normally at issue for Fifth Amendment protection, including statements by the defendant and other privileged information. And
but
if
we are essentially, based upon, I'm overstating the argument, redact that provision that says other documents from the statute, then why is it there?
I say it's intended to include other records of the kind enumerated, the same as we do in other criminal statutes where we have a list of specific things that are included or excluded, and then we say, or other items. It's implicit in the structure of the statute that it's other items of like kind to those that are expressly enumerated.
Explain to me why those other documents of like kind are different from what we're talking about here. What is the significance of the constitutional protection necessary in those kinds of documents as opposed to this document?
Because those kinds of documents are documents in which the defendant has a protected Fifth Amendment interest in not having been compelled to give evidence against himself. Jail record, there is no Fifth Amendment protection to protect. And so those are not disclosures by the defendant that compromise his Fifth Amendment rights and need the protection of 3:3 so that those rights can be preserved despite his having disclosed them to a mental health expert for purposes of the evaluation.
So is your argument essentially that the other documents wouldn't implicate the Fifth Amendment because there is no issue there as it relates to anything he's disclosed?
Yes. The purpose of other documents is other documents with a Fifth Amendment implication, and the jail record does not have those implications, and the trial judge was therefore correct. It was not a disclosure that's intended to have the protection that the statute carries forward from Estelle Buchanan and the like.
What if, I'm sorry, Judge, no, I should have followed. What if during the booking process, the defendant said You guys are never going to get me. I'm going to convince everybody that I'm crazy. Okay, what if he said that? And the booking agent or the supervisor there wrote that down. And as part of the evaluation that the mental health expert did, that statement, the mental health expert became aware of that statement. Would that be something that the Commonwealth would be prevented from using, or would that fall within the exception of the other documents?
If I understand the hypothetical, Judge, he made an unsolicited, spontaneous statement in front of a third party. It would not be entitled to Fifth Amendment protection.
Okay, so is that like the $8.52 or different from the $8.52?
It would be like the $8.52. It would not be entitled to Fifth Amendment protection and therefore not entitled to exclusion under 3.3.
Okay. Well, essentially here what happened is that the Commonwealth attorney took the easy way, which created problems, or we wouldn't be here, but took the easy way, looked and found that information in what was to be considered to be sealed and wasn't for his purview at the moment. If in fact he had gotten that directly from, subpoenaed it, I'm sure there's a video loop that's down there and he could have subpoenaed all of that. If he'd done that, there would be no harm, right?
Under even Mr. Spinner's rules, that would be no harm.
Right, okay. So you heard counsel argue that it could not be considered harmless error. If we agree with the appellants in this case, with Mr. Spinner, that the Commonwealth attorney should not have had access to that he shouldn't have gained access in the way in which he did. Okay, if we agree with that, why could this not be harmless error?
Well, I think it is harmless error. The trial judge, counsel argued this morning, thought this was a puzzle where all the pieces finally fit together. It never mentioned as one of the pieces that was critical to its determination the jail records. I don't think it even mentioned the fact that he had was of limited means from the other unobjected evidence, but it specifically didn't mention jail records. And as the panel has mentioned, earlier this morning, there was other evidence that he had limited means. The bank records came in without any objection to, well, there was a hearsay objection, but without any objection that referenced his Fifth Amendment rights or any exclusion of poverty evidence. The evidence from the executed search warrant showed he had limited means at that point. It's an argument made new this morning that you would bring all your money to jail so you'd be able to pay the commissary. I'm not sure people are presumed to be able to organize when they're arrested and what they will have on hand when they're brought to jail. I don't think that argument carries much weight. And as we pointed out in brief, when this court chose not to grant right to appeal on the sufficiency evidence and summarize the evidence of guilt lies before the Commonwealth, it didn't see a necessity to reference the jail information to find that there was sufficient evidence to support the finding of guilt. There's an argument made on brief, they don't appear this morning, that it was not harmless because there was some uniquely prejudicial nature of poverty evidence. We didn't articulate that very well on brief about why that's waived, but it appears from their opening brief what they're arguing is that it was not harmless because it was...
It's a gravamen of the theory of the case by the prosecution.
Under this poverty evidence objection. Our argument that it's waived is because the argument seems to rely on this poverty evidence rule excluding this otherwise from evidence, and that ruling was never made by the trial court. So to the extent the argument relies on an evidentiary ruling, it just wasn't made. But I think that the central part, the reason the trial court was correct, was simply that it was not a disclosure that the legislature or Estella Buchanan intended to be protected because there was no Fifth Amendment protection that he was put in this box that Estella recognized. You either disclose this to an expert, which normally would waive your Fifth Amendment privileges, or you don't get the benefit of the expert. The purpose of the statute is to allow him to make a limited disclosure of otherwise Fifth Amendment protected information and retain that protection under the statute without that waiver giving it away.
Is our analysis,
so it's not Fifth Amendment,
is our analysis any different based on the fact that this was a judge trial as opposed to a jury trial?
I think the harmless error analysis is different because the court can parse what evidence it's considering. I think whether it's admitted as part of the commonwealth's case or not, it's the same body case. I'll speak just briefly about the Miranda issue before I stand down. Again, as in both our arguments, we, as we're obliged to, raised some of the threshold issues about what's the nature of the actual issue preserved and presented, and grounds, alternate grounds for affirming the trial court's decision. But as with the 3:3 argument, I think trial court hit the nail on the head with Miranda issue as well. And that is that Mr. Spinner was not in custody for purposes of Miranda at the time he made the statements during the course of the execution of the search warrant. For Miranda, it requires not just that he be detained in some nature, it requires that it be detained either by formal arrest or restraint to the degree associated with formal arrest. And he simply wasn't. He was at a family home, he was in the driveway, he was detained for only as long as it took to execute the search warrant. There's no indication that cooperating would speed the officers leaving or that not cooperating and giving statements would make it last longer. He chose when to stop speaking, and they honored that choice when he said he's not going to talk anymore. And he knew throughout this that as soon as the search warrant was completed, the officers were going to leave and he was going to stay. He knew that he was not being detained in a Miranda protected sense. It's in the brief, I don't want to spend time on it beyond mentioning it unless the court has questions. But there's also, what we argue under Duckworth, a perfectly adequate Miranda having been given at that time. The fact of his not getting an attorney, if any charge are placed under Duckworth, does not impermissibly condition Miranda, and if anything, it makes clear to Mr. Spinner that there aren't any charges placed. He's not being placed under arrest.
Well, and didn't Williams even spread that a little bit wider by stating that they approved the language, if you cannot afford an attorney, the court will consider appointing an attorney for you. So it sort of expanded it just a little bit as well.
Yes. Miranda, the decision of Miranda is a functional test. It's not as they said, parsing the easement or construing the will. As the court has other questions on either of those issues, we will stand on our briefs and ask the judgment of the circuit court below be affirmed.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for the extra minute. I have two quick responses. The first is that the Commonwealth does not address our Sixth Amendment issue, which is the clearest cut constitutional problem in this case. One cannot force capital defense attorneys to turn over leads against their client for use in the Commonwealth's case in chief to prove their guilt. That's simply a Sixth Amendment problem. Again, that has to be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Regarding harmless error, I would simply like to say that the trial court did not delineate any of the evidence except for referring to Mr. Spinner's statements. So that is not a compelling reason.
Do you agree with your opponent colleague's suggestion that the fact that it's a judge trial makes our inquiry a little bit different than if it were a jury trial?
Your Honor, I don't think that makes a difference on the facts of this case. What matters is that the prosecution relied heavily on this evidence. The prosecution, by its own admission, looked at Mr. Spinner's disclosures and said, these records are valuable, and I'm going to rely on them. That's the word that the prosecutor used, valuable. And he mentioned them in opening, and he mentioned them in closing. We don't know much about what the judge thought. He did not delineate all the reasons for his verdict, but under these circumstances, it simply can't be found harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. I ask you to reverse and remand Mr. Spinner's convictions for a retrial without this evidence or or the evidence of Mr. Spinner's statements, though I didn't get to address those today.
Thank you.
Thank you.